Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Haunted History. I'm your host, Megan, and every week I'm going to be taking you on a little journey through our world's haunted history. As always, I hope everyone had a great week and weekend. My first day of autumn was almost completely perfect. It was cold and rainy, so I had the fireplace going, and I brought out my cozy slippers and a cup of hot cocoa. But sadly, I've been so sick with this head cold and flu, which I'm still recovering from, by the way. So I've got my hot lemon here to help me through this episode because the show must go on. I do have another movie recommendation to give you guys, two actually. I'm a little bit of a movie addict, so you will get these from time to time. The first one is Talk to Me. It's an Australian horror thriller about a group of friends who get into trouble after they learn to conjure spirits. And it was so good. It was probably one of the best that I've seen in a long time, actually. If you like those type of really scary thrillers, with a little bit of gore, it did have some gore, definitely check it out. And if you're looking for something a little bit tamer, but still, you know, still a thriller, still good, I saw A Haunting in Venice, and that's based on Agatha Christie's books of the same name. I think the first one was Murder on the Orient Express, and then the second one was Death on the Nile, and now this is the third, A Haunting in Venice. I got to see that one in the theater, so that was really fun. It kind of adds to the spookiness of it. And every October, I actually do a scary movie TV show marathon for the whole month. So I do a movie or show every night, and I try not to repeat anything from the previous years. So if you want to see what I'm watching for some inspiration, I'm going to be sharing them to my Instagram stories every night. And I have one more thing to share. We're going to surprise you guys with not one, but two bonus Halloween episodes for the month of October. So make sure you follow the podcast or my socials so you don't miss any updates. Now, today's story is one that many of you may not be familiar with. It's the shocking story of America's real-life ghost girls who, along with the public, were poisoned for a profit at the hands of big corporations. But how did something marketed as being able to increase vitality ultimately lead scores of young, healthy women to their deaths? And was justice ever served for these women? Let's find out together, as today I'm telling you the story of the Radium Girls. This story contains elements of body horror, labor abuse, and plain old sexism. Imagine that you are on the cusp of one of history's most significant documented periods of turmoil. It's December 1898, and the First World War is still 17 years away. Yet political turbulence is already brewing in Europe. Amidst all this, Pierre and Marie Curie, a husband and wife team of scientists, are tinkering in their laboratory. Marie, who grew up poor in Poland, was the daughter of a school teacher who lost his job due to his pro-Polish sentiment at a time where Poland was a kingdom being divided up by Austria, Prussia, and the Tsarist Russia. Although her father schooled her himself in classical literature and the sciences, as a woman, Marie was very limited in her ability to get a higher education. Because of her hunger for learning, Marie had to enroll in what was called a floating university. So these floating universities were essentially secret classrooms designed to run undetected by the Tsarist presence by constantly changing locations. The classrooms were run by pro-Polish nationalists, and they even allowed women. Through no doubt a lot of hard work, she eventually made her way to the prestigious Sorbonne University in Paris and would go on to complete her master's in physics in 1893. Her husband, Pierre Curie, who was 10 years older than her, was already an accomplished scientist when they met. Having done some work on magnetism, Pierre was fortunate enough to be the son of a respected French physician and thus able to receive private tutoring, in addition to the fact that he was also, you know, a man. As a part of her doctorate studies, Marie decided to extrapolate on the work of Henri Becquerel. In 1896, Henry discovered that uranium emitted rays very similar to X-rays. He was actually able to demonstrate that the rays came from the uranium itself, not some outside source. Marie took Henry's findings even further and suspected that the rays emitted from the uranium came from the substance on an atomic level. Marie coined the term radioactivity to describe this effect. Pierre joined his wife Marie in her exploration of the radioactive properties of uranium. In their research, they found that two of the ores found in uranium were considerably more radioactive and assumed that this must be because they contained undiscovered radioactive elements. It was when they began isolating these elements that the Curies discovered a new element, radium. I'll take a moment here to note that for their contribution to science, the French Academy of Sciences nominated Henri and Pierre as candidates for the Nobel Prize in Physics. However, it took some heavy advocating by a third party, Swedish mathematician Magnus Gösta, in order for Marie to be included in the nomination. The trio, Henri, Marie, and Pierre, would eventually win the prize in 1903 for their work. So just picture this for a minute. The political and social climate of Europe is tense, and out of this disorder comes a beacon of discovery. And beacon truly is the right word, as radium is an element that literally glows in the dark. So think incandescent, fluorescent light, reminiscent of the ethereal glow of a firefly. For some, it was truly magical, and maybe it's under this illusion, this spell, that many fell. I bet it would have been easy to fall into the comfort provided by the thought of a miracle, not even miracle, but magical product, especially during a time where so many parts of our everyday lives seemed beyond our control, and forces greater than ourselves were putting the pieces in place for a worldwide conflict. And so, it's on this stage that the newly discovered element, radium, made its grand entrance. What's notable about this story is the fact that radium made its way into everyday life almost instantaneously. Radium, of course, isn't magical. Now, let's see how much you remember from high school science class. Radium is a naturally occurring radioactive metal formed when uranium decays. It's made up of four isotopes, all of which are radioactive and have different half-lives. As radium decays, it releases radiation. This radiation activates fluorescent chemicals and results in radioluminescence. The radioactive isotopes were used in medicine pretty quickly, being used as an alternative to surgery to treat cancers by exposing the cancer cells to radiation. This, however, very unfortunately, led to mislabeling radium as healthful as opposed to a targeted medicine. So it actually became used as a cure-all for everything from arthritis and tuberculosis to skin conditions like eczema. It was even said to increase vitality and help with sleep. All of this without any proof, really. This widespread use pushed U.S. companies to do what they do best and capitalize on the growing interest and find ways to use radium. Radium began finding its way into a wide range of products like makeup, skincare, toothpaste, tonics, and even chocolate. Because of its glowing quality, radium was also used in paint and applied to household items for that glow-in-the-dark finish. Most notably, it was applied to watches used by soldiers in the trenches at night as a way for them to check the time without triggering enemy fire. And I just want to take a moment here to sit with this fact. It's something that I had never really thought of in its entirety, but the idea that radium would be discovered on the cusp of World War I and then quickly applied to warfare under the guise of something so innocuous as checking your watch in the trenches is kind of haunting in its own right, isn't it? It's like we've reached this twisted intersection of the extraordinary capabilities of humankind through scientific discovery Our ability for extreme viciousness, as seen by the very idea of a world war, and the banality of checking your watch in the middle of all of it, a truly haunting vignette of human history. Now, dear listener, is when we fall into the crux of our story. The main supplier of radium in this story is the United States Radium Corporation, who, in a scene straight out of a Marvel comic, mined for radium ore in Paradox Valley, Colorado. U.S. Radium then marketed their finished product, a high-tech paint, under the brand name Undark. U.S. Radium was also a defense contractor, which is why they were tasked with supplying radioluminescent watches to the war effort. The company operated between 1917 and 1926. One of the more glamorous jobs, you could say, that were created as a result of the war economy was the dial painter position. Three factories in the United States employed dial painters as a part of their operations. The first one was in Orange, New Jersey, and it opened in 1917. It was owned by the aforementioned U.S. Radium. There were also two more, one in Ottawa, Illinois, and one in Waterbury, Connecticut, both operating in the 1920s. These factories churned out household goods painted with Undark, like doll's eyes and light switches, but they also produced products that were put toward the war effort. The job of the dial painter was to carefully apply radium-laced paint on things like watch dials and clock hands in order to give them that glow-in-the-dark effect we discussed earlier. Now, as you can imagine, many, many men were off fighting in the war, and so it was mostly women who were employed as dial painters during this time. Radium-laced paint was made of powdered radium, zinc sulfide, gum arabic, and water, and dial painters were assured that the paint was safe to use. The women handled, and in a lot of cases, ingested the paint. Because you see, after a couple of applications, the camel hair paintbrushes used during the painting process would lose their shape. So it's important to note that dial painters were paid by the piece. So this meant that in order to save on time and material, the women were encouraged by management to dip the tips of the paintbrushes in their mouths in order to get that smooth pointed tip that made the application easier and faster. The process was actually called lip dip paint. Cute, right? Well, just keep listening. As I mentioned earlier, the top brass of the corporations and the factory owners were publicly saying that the use of radium paint was harmless. What's more, the men who worked at the factories who handled the raw materials always wore protection. That's right. Men working for U.S. Radium would wear lead aprons to protect them from radiation. It was widely believed that because women in the factories were dealing with such small quantities, it was harmless. Feeling strong and confident by this, and the aura of being an empowered woman that was now a part of the workforce, dial painters began daring new looks offered by the perks of their jobs. It became very fashionable to paint your teeth and nails with radium paint before a night on the town. This look carried a certain status, as the factory women were quite literally glowing. Most of these women were actually still young girls. They were only aged between 14 and 20 years old. They became known as the radium girls. The dust from the factory would sometimes sprinkle on the women's coats and skin and hair, giving them this ethereal glimmer. For this reason, they were also sometimes more ominously referred to as ghost girls. By 1920, over 300 women were employed at the U.S. Radium Factory in Orange, New Jersey. One woman was Grace Fryer. In 1922, Grace found herself in the doctor's chair. She was concerned, as anyone would be, because a few of her teeth had begun to literally and inexplicably just fall out. Her jaw was also very swollen. With the use of an earlier iteration of what we now know as the common X-ray machine, her doctor made a gruesome discovery. Grace's jawbone was riddled with small holes. What was causing Grace's ailments was initially unknown. However, she was soon joined at the ranks by other young women suffering similar illnesses. Needless to say, before long, the dots were connected, and it became apparent that many employees of the U.S. radium factory in Orange were very much suffering from a common affliction. In fact, the diagnosis of factory workers with honeycombed jaws became known as radium jaw. Later, radium jaw would be categorized as an occupational disease that consisted of necrosis of the upper and lower jaw bones, bleeding gums, ulcers, and bone tumors. It was essentially the effect of radium poisoning, with the element slowly boring holes into the women while they were still alive. The first woman to die from radiation poisoning as a result of working at the Undark factory was a prolific dial painter named Molly Maja. During the same year that Grace fell ill, in 1922, Molly had developed painful toothaches and eventually severe pain in her limbs that made it impossible for her to walk. After months of repeat dental visits, Molly's dentist was performing a surgery for what he thought would be the removal of an abscess in her jaw. During the process, he noted that the bone in Molly's gums looked ashy. He prodded it with his finger, and to his horror, it literally crumbled into dust. During that procedure, Molly's entire left jaw was removed, or more like effortlessly pulled out. 8 months after her initial toothache, Molly was dead, with the tumor in her jaw having cut through her jugular vein, flooding her throat with blood. She choked to death in bed. 3 years after her initial diagnosis, Grace began to investigate the possibility that her time at the U.S. radium factory had contributed to her sickness. In the process, a doctor named Frederick Flynn, who claimed to be affiliated with Columbia University, offered to examine her. As I tell this story, I imagine the character of Frederick Flynn kind of coming into human form out of the shadows and steepling his fingers like some sort of overly caricatural Mr. Burns. This is because Dr. Frederick Flynn was no doctor at all, and after diagnosing Grace as being in perfect health, it was later revealed that he was on the payroll of U.S. Radium. What's more, a colleague of his, who also offered to weigh in on Grace's examination, revealed himself to literally be a U.S. Radium vice president. It would be almost comical if the stakes hadn't been so tragic. This is because this event was a small-scale picture of the whole, as the radium girls began to put the pieces together and realized that the radium was never safe. The corporations and companies began a steady campaign intent on discrediting them. One of the more infuriating parts of this story lies in the fact that many doctors and dentists, their pockets probably heavily lined with payouts from U.S. Radium, would publicly diagnose the women as having symptoms related to syphilis in an effort to attack the women's reputations. Women like Molly Maja, who was initially publicly reported as having died of syphilis. This would be proven as being not true, but the nerve required to make such a statement is baffling. It also just so happened that in 1920, U.S. Radium hired a Harvard physiology professor, Dr. Cecil Drinker, to assess the working conditions at the Undark factory. Dr. Drinker reported that the workers showed signs of unusual blood conditions and that they were all gravely contaminated. U.S. Radium presented the report to the New Jersey Department of Labor, but removed all the negative annotations, even going as far as to replace some of the particularly odious passages with overly syrupy praise, celebrating the health of the women working at the factory. What adds insult to injury is the fact that Dr. Drinker had made several recommendations that would serve to better protect the workers, all of which were ignored. Ultimately, it was Alice Hamilton, a colleague of Drinker's, who discovered the fraudulent report and convinced Dr. Drinker to publish the full, truthful report in a scientific journal. He did so in 1925, much to the anger of U.S. Radium. The Radium Girls were facing an uphill battle against a heartless Goliath, but determined and perhaps even motivated by the scathing injustice and untruths manufactured by U.S. Radium and other radium companies in the U.S., the Radium Girls didn't give up. In 1927, after having searched for 2 years for a lawyer who would represent her, Grace Fryer finally filed an official lawsuit, along with four other dial painters, Quinton McDonald, Albina LaRice, Edna Hussman, and Catherine Schaub. The dial painters first appeared in court in January of 1928. By April, they were too weak to even attend a hearing. The hand of justice was anything but swift in this case, with court proceedings taking an excruciatingly long time. In what can only be perceived, in hindsight, as a deliberately evil act, the judge overseeing the case pushed the hearing all the way to September, as many of the U.S. radium execs were summering in Europe. It's definitely implied that the delay tactics were thinly veiled attempts to let the women die before achieving justice for their rightful cause. National outrage finally outweighed the vacations of a few corporate bigwigs, and the case was moved forward to June. At the last minute, as it often is with these things, the case was settled out of court in 1939. The victims received the equivalent of $100,000 in today's money, with an extra $600 collected yearly for as long as they lived. As you can imagine, barely any annuity payments were ever paid, as the victims died shortly after the settlement was reached. Grace Fryer had died in October of 1933, 6 years before the Radium Girls won their plight. The personal saga of the Radium Girls resulted in two major contributions to human history: advancements in the understanding of effects of radiation on the human body, and the kickstarting of a slew of labor rights in the U.S. During the period of time that U.S. Radium was being investigated for its role in the deaths of its workers, the bodies of women like Molly had to be re-examined. They were found to have signs of radioactive poisoning and gave us insight to our modern understanding of the effects of radium on humans. You see, radium acts a little bit like calcium in the body. Once it's inhaled or ingested and present in the bloodstream, it concentrates in the bones in high quantities. As the radium decays, it emits particles that irradiate the cells on the bone surface. It kind of acts like a little machine gun, boring holes into the bones and rendering to splinters, eating away at the collagen. A truly gruesome fate. In 1949, U.S. Congress passed a bill making all occupational disease compensable. This is in direct relation to the landmark case that was won by the Radium Girls. Industrial safety standards and the right for individuals to sue corporations for abuse was also initiated by the lawsuit put forth by the Radium Girls. The Radium Girls were young women who felt empowered just for a moment in a society that had limited opportunities for people like them. As workers, they felt like they were contributing to the greater good and gaining some form of independence with a job that paid more than any other offered to them at that time. But it was them, in fact, paying the price, the ultimate price. Those women brought the plight of workers to light, and they fought with their spirit even as their bodies withered. Hauntingly, Marie Curie also died from complications due to radiation exposure. It's said that her notebooks are still heavily contaminated, as the half-life of radium is 1,600 years. Because of this, her bones and the bones of the Radium Girls are still glowing wherever they're buried today. Marie Curie's discovery was one of humankind's most important, but it also kickstarted a chain reaction of chaotic events that would scar the course of history, some of which we'll undoubtedly explore in the future. Well, that's it for me this week. I'll see you all next Tuesday for another episode of Haunted History.